John Perkins is an economist and author who was recruited by the National Security Agency in 1968. He spent the next 3 years in the Peace Corps in South America, and in 1971 joined an international consulting firm as chief economist, where his job was to convince third world countries to accept enormous loans for infrastructure development and to guarantee that the development projects were contracted to U.S. corporations like Halliburton and Bechtel. One significant epiphany later, Perkins resigned and founded Independent Power Systems, an alternative energy company. The rest of his career has been devoted to activism and to telling the truth about his former bosses. He is a founder and board member of Dream Change and the Pachamama Alliance, nonprofit organizations devoted to establishing a world our children will want to inherit. Perkins' books on economics and geopolitics, including The Stress-Free Habit from 1989, 1997's Shape-Shifting, Confessions of an Economic Hitman from 2004, and The Secret History of the American Empire from 2007, has sold more than 1 million copies, spent months on bestseller lists, and are published in more than 30 languages. Memo to all writers in the room, by the way, Confessions received 30 rejection slips before its eventual publication, so take heart. His latest book is Hoodwinked, An Economic Hitman Reveals Why the World Financial Markets Imploded and What We Need to Do to Remake Them. Like I said, he lives just across the water, so it's long overdue that I offer a welcome to reformed economic hitman, John Perkins.
Thank you. Thank you. Boy, these lights, I can't see you very well, but it's great to have you here. Thank you so much, Ware, and thank you, the bookstore and town hall, for having us all here tonight. It's a great privilege to be with you. And I think the talk tonight is on the prophecy of 2012, and I'd like to begin by saying that I believe, are the most fortunate, most privileged people that have ever lived on this planet, because we live at a time of tremendous revolution. This is the biggest revolutionary time that's happened. I think what we're experiencing today is bigger than the agricultural revolution. It's bigger than the industrial revolution. It's huge, and you're part of it. The indigenous people tell us that every one of us is born into this body, to your parents, at this particular time in history, because you have a mission. Now, in our culture, we don't spend a lot of time going into our missions. We tend to talk about goals, you know, get good grades, go to a good university, get a good job, find a good spouse, have a good kid, send the kid to a good school to get good grades, to go to a good college. But if you were born amongst indigenous people, almost in the entire world. I've worked with indigenous people on every continent where there are indigenous people. There aren't any on Antarctica. I haven't been there yet. If you were born with any of these people, you would grow up spending a great deal of your life figuring out your mission and how to accomplish it, and your name would change during your lifetime as you approach that. But I think that we're all here. I believe this very strongly. Because we have a mission, you have a mission, and you're born at this amazing time in human history that's like no other. And I'm going to talk about the prophecies in just a moment. But I think it's so significant when you really delve into it and understand that for the first time in human history, every person on this planet, in fact, every sentient being on this planet, is being faced by the same crises. It's never happened before. We had blizzards in this part of the country and tsunamis in Asia and hurricanes in Florida, but they never impacted the other regions too much. But today, every life form on this planet is impacted by global climate change. Regardless of what you think causes it, it's happening. The glaciers are melting. The oceans are rising. We know that. Every life form on this planet is impacted by declining population, by declining resources, resources that are declining at accelerating rates. And the prices of essentials, food and fuels and other essentials that are increasing at accelerating rates. Overpopulations, species extinction, we're all impacted by that. Everything on this planet is being impacted. And for the first time in human history, and this is big, we're all talking to each other by cell phones and the internet. Never happened before. A few years ago, I was up high up in the Himalayas at about 17,000 feet, standing next to a glacier, talking to a nomadic tribal chieftain up there. And he was lamenting the fact that his people would never have telephones because the lines would never reach there. I'd hear the same thing from people deep in the Amazon. I can walk out of here tonight and call that tribal chieftain. He now, his people have a satellite cell phone. And so do they deep in the Amazon. We're all communicating with each other. We're talking. And we're seeing phenomenal change occur. The Middle East started in South America, where 10 countries in the last few years have elected presidents democratically, peacefully, who have said, we want change. No more exploitation by foreign corporations. No more destruction of our environment. 10 countries representing more than 80% of South America. And during most of my lifetime, every one of these countries, every single one of these 10 countries was run for most of my lifetime by brutal dictators, primarily put into power by the CIA and kept there by the CIA. That's all changed in less than a decade. And now we're seeing a huge undercurrent of revolt in the Middle East. We're feeling it at home in places like Wisconsin and many other places. There's something incredible happening. This is an amazing time. And you're it. You're in it. What a privilege. How exciting. What more could you ask out of life? Seems a little daunting at times, doesn't it? But that's good, you know. Who wants to have it easy? Challenges are good. And maybe some of you don't feel that way right now, but you will. You will. And these are times that have been prophesized by every indigenous culture that I know, and I've worked with a lot of them. And I start with a little story. Actually, people have always told me I should always start a talk with a joke. But believe me, you don't want me to start a talk with a joke because I always muff it. So, but I'm going to tell a little story, which is kind of funny, and you can laugh at it. It wasn't funny at the time, but it is in retrospect. I went in the Peace Corps in 1968, fresh out of business school. And the Peace Corps sent me to a training camp in Southern California for 8 weeks to learn Spanish. And if you've ever learned another language, you know 8 weeks ain't a lot of time, you know. And also to learn to be a credit and savings co-op specialist, because I'd come out of business school. And then they sent me to Ecuador. Next thing I know, I'm on this rickety old wooden bus for 2 days, going up over the Andes and down to the end of the road to the Amazon. I'm going to be sent deep into the Amazon. It actually requested it. And so I'm on this rickety old bus that's filled with chickens and goats and pigs and people and babies. And every living creature on that bus was vomiting for most of those 2 days, including me. Especially me. Finally, at the end of 2 days, we get to the end of the road. We're in the Amazon. I now got a 2-day walk to the site where I'm supposed to spend the next 2 years. So as I'm walking in, I figured there's people walking out, and I figured this is a good time for me to practice my Spanish. And to my chagrin, I discovered that the people walking out don't speak Spanish. They're Shuar, indigenous people. They speak Shuar. My first experience with U.S. government work, teach me another language for 8 weeks and send me to people that don't speak that language. How many of you have ever seen a shrunken head or a picture of one? Oh, good. Well, that's the Shuar did it. They're the only people, they're headhunters around the world, but the Shuar are the preeminent head shrinkers today. And so I'm on my way in to spend the next 2 years with the Shuar. So I'm really going through a very traumatic experience. I joined the Peace Corps because I didn't want to go to Vietnam. I didn't believe in Vietnam. But believe me, as I'm walking for 2 days in this jungle, feeling very homesick, crying the whole time, nobody can tell because it's the rainforest, you know, it's raining. I'm going in there and I'm thinking, damn, I wish I'd gone to Vietnam. People speak English there. Finally, I get to the site where I'm going to spend the next 2 years, and there's one guy there who speaks Spanish. He is the school teacher. He's from up in the Andes, speaks Spanish. But he doesn't really believe that I speak Spanish. He maintains that I don't. He says he can understand me, but he's not quite sure what language I'm speaking. But I tell him, as I arrive there, he greets me and I say, "So here I am to help you guys form your credit and savings co-ops." He looks around and he says, "Credit and savings? We don't have any money here. Money doesn't last in the Amazon anyway. And plus, it's all barter here. You know, you're guinea pig for my bananas." So he says, "We requested an agricultural co-op specialist." So I don't know a damn thing about agriculture. So very, very quickly, I discovered that I had absolutely nothing to teach these people. All my years of this vaunted education in the United States had nothing to offer these people. But I also learned very quickly that they had a great deal to teach me. They had a lot to teach me about relationship. They were so into relationship with each other, with the plants and the animals and the rivers, with everything, with nature. All their gods and goddesses are these nature spirits. And that really just means that you deeply, deeply connect and honor the trees and the plants and the animals. And so it was an incredible teaching experience that I had with these people. And the other thing is that because I grew up as a Calvinist in New Hampshire, I come from about 350 years of New Hampshire Yankee Calvinist, New Hampshire and Vermont, we're taught that when you are assigned a job to do, by God, you do it. So every night I got up and gave a talk about the importance of credit savings co-ops. In my lousy Spanish, which nobody could understand. But a funny thing happened. Every day, every night, more people gathered around me. And it got to a point where people were walking for 5 hours through the jungle, and then they had to walk home. They didn't have flashlights, you know, in the dark, so they're all coming. And I'm like, "Thanks, Mom and Dad. Calvinism really works." The school teacher takes me aside at some point, and he says, "Hey, you know, have you noticed that we don't have any radios here? We don't have any televisions. We don't have electricity. We don't have any newspapers. Nobody can read. You're illiterate. Have you noticed we don't have any of these things?" He says, "You're it." Saturday Night Live. Every night, you know, the jungle drums, and they use them there. The jungle drums that beat out this rhythm that there was this tall, gangly, crazy gringo who couldn't speak a language that anybody understood, didn't know how to shoot a blowgun, couldn't track a jaguar, cried all the time, and every night gets up and talks about something that nobody can understand anyway, and the one guy who couldn't understand it says it doesn't make any sense anyhow. He's crazy, and he's not going to live for very long, so you better come see him. And it was very much at that time that I get the message, you know. I got nothing to teach these people, but man, do they have a lot to teach me. And then I get very ill. I lost probably 35, 40 pounds in a week. Hey, I'll sell you that diet. I was dying, and I couldn't get out. A two-day walk, two-day bus ride, there was no way I could get back to the doctors in the Andes. I was resigned to dying. And then late one afternoon, the school teacher comes up to me, and he's leading this decrepit-looking old schwa man by the hand. And he says, "This guy is the shaman. He can cure you." And I'm like, "Oh, yeah, right. Like, I'm from New Hampshire. Give me another one." And the guy looks, the old man looks at me, and I can cure you. You know, this is all being translated. So what the heck? I figure, well, what have I got to lose? So this old man, he steps back, and he looks at my feet, and he looks up my body, up to my head, and he looks me up and down, and he stands up real close to me. He's a lot shorter than me. He looks up, and he says, "You're dying." And that's good, because the Schwa believe in reincarnation. And he figured my life was about as bad as it could possibly get. Time to move on to the next one. So I think at that point I started crying once again. And he says, "Oh, well, maybe you're not ready, in which case I can cure you tonight. I can shape-shift you out of this. The title of one of my books, I can shape-shift you out of this. So I said, I think I'll take that. And he did. That night he did a classic shamanic ceremony on me. The details are in the book, Shape-Shifting. But to make a long story short, it was an incredible experience. We couldn't talk or anything. He played music, and I went through this vision quest all night long. And what I saw was that my parents brought me up to be very, very hygienic. New Hampshire, Yankee, Calvinist. We only ate meat and potatoes. You didn't eat onions. You didn't eat garlic. My wife's in the audience. She remembers my parents. They never did eat garlic or onions. You know, nothing like that. You washed your hands about 500 times a day. Very hygienic. Well, now I'm living with the Shuar. And the Shuar have a very different concept of life. Their most popular food is something, it's a kind of beer called chicha. It's made by the women chewing a manioc root and spitting it. Some of you, I think, have been with the Achua. Are there anybody in the audience that's been there? Yes, you've had chicha. Isn't it wonderful? So the Amazonian people don't drink the water in the rivers because it's polluted by organic matter. But they drink a lot of chicha because you got to rehydrate. That's the only thing they drink, the spit beer. And you eat these strange things, too. Like you reach inside an old rotting log and pull out a handful of squirming grubs, wait, grubs, and eat them live. Very nutritious. But, you know, I saw on the street, I ate all these things and drank the beer because there weren't any Cliff Bars available. But every time I saw on this journey that every time I ate these things and drank this beer, my mom was standing over my shoulder saying, son, it'll kill you. And on this journey that night, I saw that the Shuar are some of the healthiest people I'd ever met. The men are all built like Rambo, right? And the women are pregnant. They're very, very sexy. They're very fertile. People live to be very old. They're hunters and gatherers, so they die sometimes in dugout canoe accidents, tipping over, snake bite. But if they don't die from an accident, they live to be very old. So on that night, I saw that what was killing me was not the food. It was a mindset that had been instilled in me. And that night, I changed my mindset. And the next morning, I woke up and I was fine. I fell in love with these people, the Shua. I spent 3 years in the Peace Corps there. I was in the Peace Corps for 2 years. I spent 3 years. I would have extended more than 3 years if they'd let me, but they wouldn't. I go back a lot now. I have 3 godchildren there. And it was a profound experience. Mindset. And I tell this story because that's where we are today, I think. We must have a mindset change if we want to survive as a species. We are at this revolutionary time. We must shapeshift. We are at a time when what we do know is that the world we've created is a failure. The economic system we've created is a failure. I'm an economist by training. Less than 5% of us live here in the United States. We consume more than 25% of the world's resources, while roughly half the world, 3 billion people, are starving to death and are on the verge of starvation. That is a failed system. There's no other way to describe it. It's not a model. You can't sell it to the Africans, the Indians, the Chinese, the Latin Americans. You need another 5 or 6 planets just like this one without people to do that. And despite Avatar, it ain't happening. We've got to fix it. We're on an extremely fragile space station. But unlike the one our astronauts built, this one doesn't have any shuttles. We can't get off. We've got to fix it. I have a 3.5-year-old grandson living across the sound here over on Bainbridge Island where I live, Grant. His mom and dad own Local Harvest, a local organic food restaurant over there in Bainbridge. Highly recommend it. Great food. Every time I take Grant by the hands, this little 3.5-year-old boy, I look at him and my heart just goes out like, what is this world going to look like when he's my age, 6 decades from now? We have to ask that question. And we know if we continue on this path, it'll be ugly. But we've got to turn it around. And we have to understand that the only way Grant or any of our children or grandchildren here is going to experience a sustainable, just, and peaceful world is if every single child growing up in Botswana, in Ethiopia, in Cambodia, in Israel and Palestine, in every corner of this planet, if every child has to have that same experience, because we live in such a tiny, integrated planet today, unlike ever before. The only way our children and grandchildren are going to have a world that they will want to inherit is if every child on this planet has this world, and we must face that. Yes. Thank you. Thank you. Walking in here, my wife and I passed two little girls outside that were hugging this dog of theirs. And whenever I see children, and I hope that every time any of you see children, think about that, that every child on this planet has to have this kind of a world. Never been this way before. We used to be able to take care of the state of Washington or the country of the United States, and to hell with the rest of the world. That's no longer true. We've got to take care of all sentient beings, and not just human beings. So we're at this time of revolution. And it is a time that's been prophesied. So some of those prophecies, a lot of you know of the prophecy of 2012, the Mayan prophecy. And I take people, along with my co-facilitator, Lynn Roberts, to Guatemala. We take groups of people every December to work with Mayan shamans. I'd love to have you come. Go to my website, johnperkins.org. While you're there, subscribe to my newsletter, please. While I'm on that, also Twitter me at economic_hitman. And I'm on Facebook. Let's stay in touch. But johnperkins.org. And we'd love to have some of you come on that trip where we work with these Mayan shamans. And we work specifically, we do fire ceremonies. We do a lot of amazing things around the prophecy of 2012. Now, the prophecy of 2012 is not at all like the Hollywood version. It's not a doomsday prophecy. Could turn into that, I suppose. But the prophecy basically says it's a time when the 17 Mayan calendars all converge and end. And it said that this is a time to start fresh, a new start for humanity, that we're moving into a new era. And it comes specifically from the Popol Vuh, the sacred text of the Mayans, roughly the equivalent of our Bible, I suppose, something like that. The Popol Vuh says that there's a time in history that's ruled by Seventh Macaw, a king, Seventh Macaw. He's greedy, he's brutal, he's selfish, and he's been ruling for a long, long time. This is the time that we've been in. And the prophecy says that at this time in history, 2012, the hero twins will come along, representing men and women, will come along and kill Seventh Macaw, sever his head, in fact, and replace him with one Hunapu, a new leader who's characterized by compassion, by giving, by cooperation, by a whole new change of consciousness. And that's the time we're in. And the reason that 2012 is important, December 21st of 2012, is because in the Mayan, from the Mayan perspective, if you're standing on the major Mayan pyramids, when you, from that perspective, on December 21st, 2012, the sun passes through the great rift of the Milky Way, the center of the Milky Way. And the major ball courts, the Mayans built these amazing ball courts, and the major ones, not all of them, but the major ones, there's a throne at one end where the shaman sat. And if you look straight down the ball court from that throne to the straight line to the very end, on December 21st, 2012, the sun will rise right at that spot. And they've known this for 2,000 years. They've predicted this time for 2,000 years. And they say December 21st, 2012 is not an important date. It's a marker when that sun does that. But it's begun now. We're in that time now. You're in it. You were born into it. And it's going to continue for a while afterwards. This is the prophecy that we are in this time of incredible potential for change. And every indigenous culture I know all over this planet has similar prophecies. Another one is the eagle and the condor. How many people know the prophecy of the eagle and the condor? Pachamama people, who've watched the video, been to the symposiums, and I'm going to mention that again later. So the prophecy of the eagle and the condor comes out of the Andes, out of the Amazon, and went up into the Andes, and it traveled around most of the Americas, influenced the Hopi prophecies. And it basically says that it was probably first expressed 500 to 1,000 years before Christ. Nobody knows exactly when. But it said that back in the midst of history, human societies would take two paths. One would be the path of the eagle, the path of the mind, the brain, science, technology, industry. Perhaps we could call it the male path. The other part of society, human society, would take the path of the condor, path of the heart, emotion, passion, intuition, female path. And they would go separate ways. But then during the fourth Pachacuti, and in Quechua, Pachacuti is a 500-year interval, the fourth Pachacuti would begin about 1500. During the fourth Pachacuti, the eagle and the condor would come together and clash. And the eagle would be so powerful it would practically destroy, drive into extinction, the condor. Of course, we know that happened. That prophecy was realized. Columbus, 1492. Look what happened to the condor peoples of the world, the heart-based people, the indigenous people. But the prophecy says that in 500 years later, in the fifth Pachacuti, year 2000, there would be the opportunity for the eagle and the condor to fly together in one sky, to soar, to dance, to mate, to create a whole new species, which they say is the Quetzalcoatl, or the Quetzal bird of Central America, the Mayan prophecy. And what this is about is saying that now we have entered this time of opportunity for the heart and the mind to come together, the male and the female, the technological, the scientific, and the intuitive, the passionate, the heartfelt sides, to come together and to take us to a new level of consciousness, a level of consciousness where we can really understand that we have to cooperate, we have to be compassionate, we have to all work together to create a world that Grant will want to inherit in every child on this planet. And every one of these prophecies, another one, I'll say one more, in Tibet. Well, I had the exceptional good fortune a few years ago of being in an airport with 30 people. I was leading a group up in Ladakh, Little Tibet, out of Indian Protectorate that used to be part of Tibet. I was in this airport getting ready to fly from Leh Ladakh to Jammu, India, and the Dalai Lama and his entourage come waltzing through. And they're going to get on the same flight, and the Dalai Lama is carrying my book, Shapeshifting. So somebody in our group goes up to his secretary and says, "You know, the author of this book's on this flight." Make a long story short, I end up, the Dalai Lama invites me to sit with him in the front seat of the airplane for this whole flight. So we're sitting there talking, and I asked him, I said, "Your Holiness, do you know that the prophecies say that the 14th Dalai Lama, you, will be the last? What do you think of that?" And he said, "Well, you know, I think I'll be the last maybe from the Himalayas. Maybe I'll be the last Buddhist Dalai Lama." That blew my mind. And he said, and I said, "Well, do you know where the next one will be from? And he said, "I'm not sure, but I think it'll be from either the Andes or the Amazon. That's why I'm reading your book." As a result of that time we spent together, he invited our whole group of 30 people to his home in Dharamsala several days later to spend an afternoon with him in his living room. And it was enlightening. Lightning, that's a good word to use. It was enlightening it was enlightening for many reasons. He said a lot of things, but I was really struck by when he first walked into the room, he welcomed us, and then he said, "I just want to say, don't become a Buddhist. The world doesn't need any more Buddhists. But do practice the Buddhist principles of compassion and love." And that hit me like, okay, so this is what he meant about being from South America, where these Andes and Andean people are not Buddhists, and that kind of blew my mind. But what he was really saying is the next leader needs to be someone who believes in compassion and love and doesn't necessarily have to know all the mantras and all the other things that Buddhist scholars are brought up to believe in. It was fascinating to hear him say that. But here's this another prophecy, the prophecy of the 14th Dalai Lama, the last. And he just stepped down about a month or so ago as as the leader of Tibet, the political leader, still the spiritual leader. But I also had this vision. Can you imagine Easter Sunday? Imagine Easter Sunday. The Pope walks out on his balcony, and he looks down in St. Peter's Square, and he said, "Just want to say one thing. Don't become a Catholic." So here we are at this time of prophecies, and I think it's really important to understand that none of the prophecies say we will achieve this higher level of consciousness. It's not automatic. We have to do it. You have to do it. That's why the twin heroes had to do it. It's not a leader that does it. Our leaders can't do it. Obama can't do it. Sarah Palin, well, can't do it. None of our leaders can do it. We have to understand they're extremely vulnerable, for one thing. Obama's in a very, very, very vulnerable position. And he can't do it. And when you think about it, we've always had to do it. The Civil War didn't end because we elected, because Abraham Lincoln found himself in the White House. Civil War ended because we elected a leader that was opposed to seeing the country divided. And then we fought a major war. We sacrificed ourselves to realize that dream of unity. We've always had to do it. We, the people, have to do it. And we have to do it this time. This is the time. And you have to do it. That's why you're here. That's why you came into that body, to those parents, at this time in history. That's why you're sitting in this room right now. We've got to do it. We're going to do it. And we're going to have fun doing it. It's a good time to be alive. It's a good time to create this change. And I just want to take a moment to talk a little bit about, take a look at the clock here, to talk a little bit about how we got here, because I think I have to take a lot of that some of that responsibility. Because we got to this position because people like me, economic hitmen, first truly global empire in the history of the world. It's a corporate empire. It's not a country empire. It's not the United States empire, really. It's a corporate empire. But it was created for the first time in history, an empire created without the military for the most part. And it's happened many different ways, but perhaps the most common that I employed was to identify a country with resources our corporations covet, like oil. Arrange a huge loan to that country from the World Bank or one of its sister organizations, but the money never actually goes to the country. Instead, it goes to our own corporations to build big infrastructure projects in that country. Power plants, industrial parks, highways, things that will benefit a few very wealthy families in that country, as well as our own corporations, the main beneficiaries. But don't help the majority of the people who are too poor to buy electricity, don't have cars to drive on highways, can't get jobs in industrial parks because industrial parks don't hire many people. And yet they're left holding a huge debt that they can't possibly repay. And so at some point we go back and say, hey, since you can't pay your debts, give us a pound of flesh. Sell your oil real cheap to our oil companies without any environmental restrictions. Let us destroy your rainforests, your deserts, your seas, whatever, your beaches. Vote with us on the next critical United Nations vote. Allow us to build a military plant, a military facility on your lands. Something along these lines. And in the few cases where we economic hitmen fail, the jackals step in. I talk in my books about how I failed with Jaime Roldós, the democratically elected president of Ecuador, and Omar Torrijos of Panama. I couldn't corrupt them. I couldn't get them to buy into the system. And as a result, they were assassinated by the jackals. The jackals either overthrow governments, as they recently did to Zelaya in Honduras, or they assassinate leaders. They're very much involved in what's going on in the Middle East today. There's an amazing behind-the-scenes story in the Middle East today. Fascinating what's going on there right now. In the few cases where the jackals also fail, as they did with Saddam Hussein, they couldn't take him out. His security was too good. He had too many look-alike doubles. Then the military steps in. So you've got this three-tiered approach. It's primarily done by economic hitmen. If they don't succeed, usually the jackals do. If they don't, then the military goes in. And in this way, we've created this empire. It's a corporate empire. It's driven by the people who run our biggest corporations. This isn't a conspiracy theory, incidentally. These people don't have to get together. They don't even have to know each other. But they control our politicians. Nobody in the United States gets elected to a major office without huge corporate support. We're certainly seeing the fruits of that with the Obama administration. I'm not trying to knock anybody here, but it's well, we're seeing it. We're seeing it all over the world. The corporatocracy controls the mainstream press, either through direct ownership or advertising budgets. They run the world. Through most of my lifetime, you could look at the globe as this, you know, this big ball with roughly 200 countries, of which a few had a lot of power, the United Kingdom, the Soviet Union, the United States at different times. Today, you'd better envision that globe surrounded by huge clouds. There are no national borders, don't respect any particular sets of laws. These are the big corporations. Strike partnerships and deals with the Chinese, the Taiwanese, and the Tibetans, the Israelis and the Palestinians, the Indians and the Pakistanis, with anybody who has resources they covet or markets. And this is the world that we're living in today, a world that's really moved from several hundred years ago, geopolitics controlled by religious organizations, then governments, now it's corporations. So the question is, what's next? And next has to be us, the realization of the prophecies, the coming together of the eagle and the condor, the Dalai Lama that rises out of a place that doesn't have Buddhism, the prophecy of the 2012, the twin heroes rising up and replacing a brutal dictator with a compassionate leader, a compassionate consciousness. We are at this time to change our consciousness, and we know it's happening. The prophecies are coming true. You know, in about 2000, the indigenous people and we began to get together. That's why books like the ones that I was writing about shamanism never would have sold a copy back in the 70s, probably. Or maybe a few freaks would have bought them, you know. Some people bought Carlos Castaneda, you know. But the fact is, in the late 90s, the mid and late 90s, people became very interested in shamanic cultures, and the shamans opened up. They invited us to their homes. They invited us to their lands. They opened up to us. The prophecies are being realized. But we have to keep pushing this and moving in this direction. And I think one of the good news aspects of this is that an empire that's run by corporations is an empire that we have control over. Because these corporations only survive because we all buy their goods and services. And the marketplace is a democracy if we choose to make it such. When I went to school in Boston, I couldn't walk beside the Charles River. It was so polluted. Not anymore. We forced the corporations to clean it up. When I went to university, there was apartheid in South Africa. For the most part, we got rid of it because we boycotted the corporations that supported it. We got them to get rid of aerosol cans, destroying the ozone layer, to hire more women and minorities, recently to get trans fats out of their foods and antibiotics out of the chickens. We have tremendous power over these corporations. But now it's time that we get the corporations to change a basic premise. Because beginning in about in the 70s and especially in 1980 when Reagan and Thatcher and Odson and a number of other world leaders embraced the what I call predatory capitalism, which was espoused by Milton Friedman in the Chicago School of Economics, there became one guiding principle for every major corporation in the world. And that principle is that the goal, the only responsibility of business is to maximize profits regardless of the social and environmental costs. That was never true when I was in business school. We were not taught that at all. We were taught that a CEO shouldn't even make that much money, decent living, but he or she needed to take care of their employees, their customers, their suppliers, and the community. Be a good citizen. That all changed in the 70s and especially in the 80s, and ever since, every U.S. president has embraced this predatory form of capitalism, Democrat and Republican alike. We need to change that. You need to change that. Don't buy any more from any corporation that has that philosophy. The new philosophy has to be, yes, give a decent rate of return to your investors. I am a capitalist, basically. There may be better systems. I'd like to see one that would come along, but right now I can't identify one, so I'll try to change this one as much as I can. Let's set a new set of rules out there. Establish a new set of rules. Make a decent rate of return. Make profit, but only within the context of creating a sustainable, just, and peaceful world. And don't buy from any corporation that won't do that. And, you know, we have to take a lot of the responsibility, because for far too long we've been sending the message. And let's face it, corporations are just people, you know? Well, you know, I've known in my lifetime a lot of CEOs, a lot of people in high management, and I personally don't know one who wants to see Florida sink beneath the oceans. I don't know any that are bad guys. I know there are some. I know Phil Knight down the road here is a sociopath at Nike. And certainly the people at Enron were sociopaths. And there's a lot of on Wall Street that are sociopaths. But there's a lot of people out there that are just receiving a message from you and me. And that message is, give me an expensive shirt. And if that has to be made in a sweatshop in Indonesia or China by slaves, I'll just look the other way. Give me cheap gas for my car. Don't you dare raise the price of gas. And if that means destroying the Amazon rainforest, I'll just look the other way. We've been doing that. And we've got to turn this around. We've got to say no more of that. For the first 100 years this country was a country, no corporations could get a charter unless it proved it was going to serve the public interest. Charters lasted on average for 10 years, and then the corporation had to go back and demonstrate that it had done that, served the public interest, and would continue to in order to renew its charter. I think we need to return to that sort of a value system. Corporations need to be good citizens. They need to serve you and me, a public interest, a public servant. They need to take care of us, not just a few people at the top. And we have the power to turn that around. So I'm going to end and go into questions and answers in just a moment. But first, just to address, you know, what can you do personally? You, what can each one of us do personally? Well, I think, you know, part of it is, and I talk a lot about this in the book Hoodwink. There's five different big categories with small categories within that. I can't go into all that, but you can read the book if you want. But I think, and part of it is how we consume or choose not to. But there's another very, very important thing here. And that is that I know that every one of you, you have passion and you have talent. I don't know what your passions are or your talents for any one of you out there. Maybe I know a few of you. I have a passion for writing and hopefully some talent in it. That's how I choose to direct most of my efforts. And standing up and talking like this. Tomorrow I go down to the Green Festival in San Francisco and we'll be talking to about 1,000 people in a similar vein. Moving people. I don't know what your passions are or your talents, but I know you get them. And so if each one of us in this room directs our passions and our talents toward creating a sustainable, just, and world, a world that little Grant is going to want to inherit, then we will achieve that. You will achieve it. So take your route. What is your passion? What is your talent? There's a young man in the audience I had dinner with a few people tonight, works for Boeing, and told me about how Confessions of an Economic Hitman convinced him that he could go in and work through Boeing and get Boeing to become more ethical in its dealings with, especially with third world countries, and he's working on that. Cornell, Columbia. And in the last 6 years since Confessions came out, as they meet with students in these places and also in schools in China and Iceland and Latin America where I also lecture, 5-6 years ago, I would hear students, when I talked to them, ask them what their goals were. They talked about money and power. I don't hear that anymore, not even at the MBA programs. I hear students today saying, I want to have kids, and I want them to grow up in a decent world. I may have to pay back some big loans, and so I may have to go to work for a big corporation, but I'm going to change that corporation, just like I heard from Eric at Boeing today. So something amazing is happening. We're seeing it in the Middle East, we're seeing it in Latin America, we're seeing it in Wisconsin, and we're seeing it all over. The fact that there's so many of you here tonight, we're seeing it. It's happening. It's in our hearts. We're experiencing it. But we need to push harder. Go into that passion. So I've talked about a young man working for Boeing. I look around, I see a few people out there that are in my generation, which is the 30 and older. You don't believe I'm 30? And I got to tell you, you know, if you're retired, you can't be fired. It's the time to rattle the cage. Get out there and do it. Mentor the young people and really rattle the cage. Spend a night in jail if you never have, you know. Go out and demonstrate like my great mentor Howard Zinn, a wonderful professor, did, you know, in the last years of his life, and Noam Chomsky's still doing it. I mean, whatever you need to do, rattle your cage. Bring in this passion. You know, honor your passion. This is going to be fun to change the world. There's nothing more gratifying than making a better world for my grandson, Grant. And I know there's a lot of passion in this room, too, because I know there's some people here from a wonderful nonprofit organization that I co-founded and am on the board of, that Weir mentioned earlier tonight, Pachamama Alliance. Huh? Anybody here connected with Pachamama Alliance, stand up. Stand up and be recognized. All right, you guys are all heroes. Heroes. So, and Peggy, where's Peggy? Peggy, so there's something about, this is a commercial break here, but you've got some cards there, and there's a Pachamama Alliance symposium coming. If you want to just tell people when that is. These symposiums are wonderful. I helped design it, so it's great.
He's in it, too.
By video.
The symposium is an event that takes place, 4 or 5 hour event, and the purpose is to inquire as to how we can bring forth an environmentally sustainable, spiritually fulfilling, and socially just human presence. So that's what we're all about. It's got a lot of luminaries in it, and it's a real wonderful program. And there's 4 of them coming up. There's also an associated program that Lightbearer is going to talk about coming up, too, on the 24th. That's for youth. So for the young people, it's called a wake-up. For us over 30s, it's a symposium. And so there's going to be one at the Seattle Green Fest coming up May 21st and 22nd. There's one in Bainbridge Island on May 7th. There's one in Port Townsend at the Ancient Wisdom Rising Conference on May 19th. And you can go out to the website as well and find others if you're from out of town.
And we'll have these flyers out on the signing
table
afterwards.
Yeah, and it's just a little handbill because we're trying to save paper. So
okay. Pick
one up. Thank you.
And there's also a whole, thank you, Peggy, and they're amazing programs. It's like, 4 hours or something?
Yeah. Right.
They're short, they're video, they're exciting, they're fun. I really encourage it. And we've got some programs that we are particularly oriented toward young people, college students. Lightbearer, can you just very quickly, I'm running out of time here, but summarize and find out, how can people get more information about those?
Well, you can check out the website. It's generationwakingup.org. We're going to be doing the Wake Up on the 21st of April at Ohm Culture Studios out by Gasworks Park. It's really exciting. You know, seeing young people turned on, I feel like, you know, there's a lot of brilliance and connection and hunger for meaning right now. And this Generation Waking Up experience is a fantastic, transformative workshop. So.
Thank you. And we also get Yes Magazine represented. They had a table out here. There'll be a sign-up sheet at the book signing. You don't have to buy a book to sign up to get their free Friday newsletter, which comes by email. I get it every Friday. It's an amazing Yes Magazine, which puts a positive slant on things. There's incredible things going on here. I know, how many people here are involved in nonprofit organizations? Wow, fantastic. Wow, and sorry I can't mention all of you, but there's one that I just agreed to serve on the board of advisors with, ClearPath, which works with victims of landmines, particularly in Asia. And Kimmon, would you stand up for just a moment, who's in charge of that one, doing great work in Asia. So I say all these things because it's the passion. You know, Pachamama Alliance was started because there was a message that came out of the Amazon. I brought the message back in 93, and now we're in over 50 countries. We have 4,000 facilitators of symposiums around the world. It's in many, many, many languages. It's organic. It's amazing, and it just spreads. And when you have this passion, you can do anything. We can do anything. Ware mentioned that my book was rejected 30 times. Imagine you have 30 rejection slips and you just keep sending the book out again. We can do anything. So I'm going to close with a quote, and then we'll go to questions and answers. But I just feel the enthusiasm and know that you are born into the most incredible time in human history. I was a great scholar of the American Revolution. When I was a kid growing up in New Hampshire, I had ancestors that fought in the Revolution. And I remember I used to think, damn, I wish I'd been born in the 1700s so I could have fought in that Revolution. This is a bigger revolution. This is huge. This is global. It's worldwide. It's also a bit more comfortable. We have better toilets. But speaking of the American Revolution, I'm going to close with a quote that came at a very dire time. This was written at a time, you know, George Washington and Martha Washington and Thomas Jefferson, these people were wealthy people in the colonies. They didn't have to do what they did. They stuck their heads in a noose. They would have all been hanged if they'd lost the revolution. We sometimes forget that. They were radicals. They were terrorists. They were traitors to their own government, the British government. But they did it. And then Washington proceeded to lose every battle he fought for a couple of years. It got bad, and the Continental Congress wouldn't support him. If you feel unsupported sometimes, think of how Washington felt. Couldn't get shoes for his men, couldn't get blankets, couldn't get bullets, couldn't get guns, couldn't get anything. He's at Valley Forge. It's really tough. So this quote comes out of Valley Forge, December 1776, Christmas time. And I think it's very relevant to the times we're in right now. Tom Paine wrote, some of you probably know this, "These are the times that try men's souls. The summer soldier and the sunshine patriot will, in this crisis, shrink from the service of their country. But he who stands by it now deserves the love and thanks of man and woman. A generous parent should say, if there must be trouble, let it be in my day that my child may have peace. If there must be trouble, let it be in my day that my child may have peace." Paine continues, "I love the man or woman who can smile in trouble, who can gather strength from distress and grow brave by reflection. By perseverance and fortitude, we have the prospect of a glorious future." Perseverance and fortitude, we have the prospect of a glorious future. And so I just want to say that I really look forward to moving into that glorious future with you. We're going to do it together. We're going to persevere. We're going to have fortitude together. And 6 decades from now, Grant, my grandson, is going to look back and he's going to say, thank God those people all came together that night in April, the town hall in Seattle, And every one of them committed to doing everything in their power to creating a sustainable, just, and peaceful world. Thank God you all came together and we all committed to working together, to taking our own individual paths, but all heading for the same destination of a sustainable, just, and peaceful world. Thank you. Thank you.